WA2PJF in Bayshore. Anyone copy?
Nice strong signal, Vito. K2UPF.
How are you? Jerry, am I correct?
Name here is Rich. Okay, you have a nice signal tonight.
Very good, Rich. Rich, okay, Richard. Yeah, I'm copying you fine via Echo Link, I guess that's what it is. Very nice. Nice, clear audio, very powerful. Nice hearing you. I'm just listening around, waiting for the professor to come on this evening and see what he has to say. Other than that, nothing special on this end. Back to you, sir.
Okay, Vito, I'm doing the same thing, waiting for the net to start. So, I'm cruising along here in Ohio, almost into West Virginia. So, I'm looking forward to the next 4 hours. Help pass the time behind the wheel.
Very good. I guess it helps keep you awake. That's very important, most assuredly. Okay, Richie, I'm going to sign. I'm going to be sitting back a few moments. I got a couple of things to do real quick before it starts. I'll be listening primarily, nothing to participate, nothing to add. But nice hearing you again, as usual. So K2UPS, WA2PJF, Vito Bayshore, bye.
Okay, 73 Vito, enjoy the net. K2UPS.
To UPS, then to FLF.
And to FLF, say to Mark, K2UPS.
Hey there, just heading home. Picked up four of those toroids, by the way. 63, I think it was, and it's all right.
Okay, cool. I think they either 43 or 61. I think either one of those, 43 would have been preferable, but either one will work.
You know, now I'm not sure. It might have been 43. I honestly don't remember.
All right, no problem. I'll just get together the other parts on the list, and I can bring over the finished one so you have a good idea what it's supposed to look like, and get cracking on putting it together.
Hey, sounds like a plan. I'm going to be on the side, and that's for the truck. I'll call to you later. Safe driving.
S2FLF73. KC2WGBN, thanks for you. KC2WGBN, thanks for you.
There is no tone. I don't hear the tone. How am I coming out?
No, you're doing fine. Sounds good.
Should I increase the power or it's okay?
No, I think it's fine.
Okay. Enter exchange, waiting for the detector.
Mission 2WGB clear.
John, one more thing. John, I look at that polarizer that I've got today. It's not that we're supposed to flip it, but we're supposed to tune it. So when you're holding it vertically, you're just turning it around. And in one particular place, everything disappears. You cannot see anything.
Okay. Well, polarizers usually work. As you rotate one of them, you see that it blacks out the image altogether. One polarizer by itself just basically cuts approximately half of the wavelength. Well, it cuts one half of the direction of the radiation.
That's right. I was putting that, placing that on two monitors, two different monitors. And what I found out is I had a position in one monitor when the screen disappeared, so it was completely blocked by the polarizer. Then I took it with the same position to another screen, and didn't help. So I had to then turn it again at different angle. I touched it.
Yeah, well, of course. It depends on the polarization of the screen you're looking at. If you had two of those devices in your hand, you could put them together and have a perfect view. But if you rotate it 90 degrees, it'll go black.
shot in it.
Yes, it is. Okay, into XG and waiting for the detectors.
Padzenie, panie Wesley.
Who is that?
Czekierzalski.
I know who's that. PPN, is that PPN?
Gomułka.
Gomułka.
Pilsudski.
Give me a call, sir. Station not recognized.
Chicken Papa 5.
Net, tonight at 8 o'clock, WQVL repeater system. Net, time.
I actually picked up the wrong microphone after all these years. Good evening, you all. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My call, my name is Dick. And this is the TechNet. TechNet number 1508 of the series that began September of 1982. Hey, John, sounds like we're going to be around a while. There's three guys that try to run this thing. John, Dick, Paul, and Hal. And, Hal. K6DPZ is Hal. WS2N is Paul, gives us our space information. John KC2WGB has got a brand new job you're going to be hearing about. And me, I try to act as the interlocutor, as they used to say in the old days. Whether or not the TechNet is interesting to you tonight, it's a function of whether or not you guys ask good questions. I will have later on a little bit more information about one of my favorite subjects, waveguide. I know a couple of secrets. I've spoken to that wave as it goes down that waveguide. I know how it feels sometimes. And so I'll tell you some of those secrets a little bit later on. One of the things that John has added, let me drop. John has added a computer program contributed to him by Rich, K2UPS, such that he is now monitoring the Echo Link. I know that in the past quite a few people have had troubles. They could hear an Echo Link and they tried chiming in and saying something, and the way we jumped the gun so fast, we didn't know that they were there. By way of John monitoring the Echo Link, we know when somebody is signed in, we know when somebody is trying to transmit, and we know you can also, I believe, send messages to John by way of the Echo Link or the chat room. So things are getting better. We don't yet have a computer way of monitoring those who are on IRLP, but maybe that's coming also. So the system is slowly evolving and improving, and we're changing the menu a little bit. Let me drop. Person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment, and he uses his call letters, his name, because I'm so forgetful, and the word yes, which means he does have a question or a comment. We don't need a very big, long list of people just signing in because they're listening. After 31 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. And by way of the Mike and Mike websites, one mic is KC2NJI, and that's the website at amateurradio.tangovictor. The last seven or so years of TechNet are all recorded, and you can play them back. So some of the stuff goes flying by pretty fast during the net itself, and maybe you didn't get a chance to absorb it all. That's normal. And learning brand new material is supposed to feel uncomfortable. In your freshman year in college during orientation, they tell you that. You're going to feel uncomfortable when you're learning new material you don't know before. And they also tell us in college, look at the guy to your left, look at the guy to your front, look at your guy to your right. When you graduate from this place, they will not be there. Only one in four get the chance to graduate from a good school. In those days, used to tell us things like that. Okay, so when you're frustrated, don't worry. You're allowed to come back and ask the exact same question over and over again. There is no such thing to John and I and Hal as a dumb question. The dumb question represents a bigger gap between what the guy knows and what he wants to know. Let me drop. So, what we try to teach each other is the magic of wireless. How in the world, when you press down the key and start sending Morse code on Long Island with 10 watts output to a simple antenna on 20 meters, when the propagation gods are favoring you and the ionosphere is in good shape, and that guy in Japan or Hawaii or Australia hears what you're doing 12,000 miles away. How in the world does that happen? Or in the case of microwaves, you look at those antennas, those pictures of mine on the other mic's website, K1 MJM, which is at LimarkTechnet.com. Go to that website and you'll see a picture of me standing in front of a 16 Yagi array on 432 and 100 feet of tower. And so my radio horizon is 43 miles away, and I talked for a solid 4 years with the K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles away, every single Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock for 4.5 years. We just couldn't believe the signal would do that. Single sideband. We talked to each other on 432, which we thought was a super high frequency in those days. Nowadays, much higher frequencies are the threshold of the frontier. Let me drop. Well, when I was working at the Rome Air Development Center, and I was driving up to Utica, New York, and I was talking to, keep forgetting his call letters, a guy in southern New Jersey, on 2 meters, and I have a simple whip antenna on my station wagon automobile, and I'm 200 miles north of him along the freeway, Route 90, and he's down there in southern New Jersey with four Yagis, moon bounce capable on 2 meters, sending me a sideband signal. I had a 180-watt amplifier sideband in the car. I'm talking back to him. 200 miles, fixed station to Mobile. And how in the world did that signal sift through the Catskill Mountains, the Adirondack Mountains, all those trees and buildings and everything else, and get to that low roadbed of the New York State Thruway and talk to me in my car? We had 90% copy all the way. How in the world did that signal do that? And so we try to teach each other a little bit about that jazz. Okay, give me your call letters right now if you got a question or a comment with your name. K2LIW, we're listening.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
We got you, Steve. And by the way, we'll also be asking you guys, what was it like at the flea market today? Well, the Limark get-together at Briarcliff College. So you're going to give us some words on that. We got Steve, MDP. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters, K2LIW. Okay, yeah, maybe your audio was a little bit heavy because you kept popping out as you talked. So the last person who signed in, who said he's got a question, give me your call letters and name one more time, but speak a little more softly. And if you're coming in by EchoLink, John will be watching your signal, if you know what I mean. That station again, K2LIW. My name is Dick. We're listening.
Hey, Dick. Here's Mike. Call time 921-2-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-
Okay, that time we got you, Mike. November 2, Yankee, Yankee, Lima. I got Mike. One more call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet? And if we run out of questions on ham radio and transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation and IRLP and Echo Link and anything, some of the other things that we talk about, moon bounce, meteor scatter, can't think of the other.
Antennas?
Are antennas important, John? Antennas? Okay. Both transmitting antennas and receiving antennas. Antennas high in the air and the antennas below ground. The antennas underwater. The antennas in tunnels. Oh, boy. The antennas that are stealthy and hidden on your car and don't show. The gap in the sheet metal between the fender and the car can be made into an antenna. The side view mirror can be made into an antenna on a law enforcement stealthy vehicle. A plainclothes vehicle. So, boy, there are antennas. There's 5,000 kinds of antennas. And I'm one of those lucky guys that developed a lot of interest in the subject, and I've worked with antennas professionally for over 30 years. So I've got some opinions. Okay, one last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for any of the above, give me your call, letters and name. K2RIW.
Spacecraft we could talk about. WS2N checking in with the spaceship. Report, Dick. Good evening, John. How?
Very, very fine, Paul. Let me drop for long enough.
KTUPS Mobile. I have a antenna question, Dick.
That mystery voice. I wonder who that was. Sounds like Rich. KTUPS with an antenna question. We're looking forward to that. And Paul, when it comes to space, I've suddenly got interested in what the moon is really doing. And so, me and Steve, K-A-2-I-H-Y, have been asked you get this great big prize. You and your lady friend can go to a real fine restaurant at our expense. KC2MDP. Believe that? K2RIW listening.
Thank you very much, Dick. Yeah, you got me laughing over here. I'm looking forward to that high-class meal you guys are going to give me. Good evening to you. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Dick, I am working on one of those Doppler location finders. And I got it to work. The only question is how crucial is the antenna placement? I think I read in there that they should not be more than a third of a wavelength between the antennas. And how crucial is the actual cut of the antenna? Let's say I'm using it for, let's just sake of argument, you know, 146-250. At the ham fest, I picked up a couple of rubber duck antennas. I'm not sure of their frequency because the thing didn't come with antennas. And how crucial is that? If you can give me a few words, that'll help me out with this thing. Appreciate it. Back to you.
Yeah, I think I understand the nature of your question, Steve. And I've got a mental image of how a dot scanner works. If this was the best of all worlds, it would be nice to have a very large record player on the roof of your car where the record spins very fast. At the perimeter of the record, you have one single antenna with its feed line coming over to the center where there's a rotary joint, and you whip that antenna around, let me pick a number, 5,000 times per second, 5,000 revolutions per second. Maybe it could be a little lower number, but as that antenna of yours on the perimeter of this very large record player is whipping around in that circle on the top of your car, assume now that the signal you want to find the direction of happens to be north of your car right now. Your car is aimed north. So during the time the record player has its single monopole antenna at the 12 o'clock position on your car, it's sweeping sideways compared to the signal, and it hears the signal normal. During the animal, we're rotating your record player clockwise top view. And so a little bit later in the rotation, the whip antenna is at the 3 o'clock position on your car, and it's moving away from the front of the car toward the rear of the car. Therefore, it's moving away from the signal that you're trying to measure the direction of. So you're moving away, you're going to get negative Doppler shift. At 6 o'clock, you're going to get zero Doppler shift again. At 9 o'clock, your antenna is moving toward the signal, you're going to get positive Doppler shift. So what happens is that the DopScan equipment looks at that wiggle back and forth in phase, which is really a wiggle back and forth in frequency, and it looks at the rate at which it looks at the timing of that signal going up and down in apparent frequency or apparent phase because your antenna is moving in that circular pattern. And
repeater, timeout.
And the DopScan equipment, it knows the synchronization of the record player. It knows where the antenna was. So it suddenly figures out that, as it draws the graph of apparent frequency of reception versus time, it's a horizontal graph, and you see the sine wave, the apparent frequency being received by your receiver from that antenna that's in motion. The apparent frequency goes up and down, and it'll notice the fact that when the antenna is on the north, there's zero Doppler shift. It goes through zero frequency shift, and it's positive Doppler shift when you're at 9 o'clock and negative Doppler shift when you're at 3 o'clock. So it looks at that correlation, the DopScan circuit, and it says, aha, I recognize that pattern. That signal is coming from the north. That would be the best way to do it. You'd have no problem. One simple antenna, one simple rotary joint, there's a catch. You can't build an antenna strong enough and a record player strong enough that can rotate your antenna 5,000 times per second like that. So instead of doing mechanical motion of the antenna, you do the poor man's equivalent. You set up four antennas, maybe, one at 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and 9 o'clock, and you sequentially switch between those antennas. So now instead of making this beautiful sine wave of Doppler shifted frequency, you end up with these steps, but still properly interpreted those steps of Doppler shift with the sequential timing of when did you connect your antenna number 1, 2, 3, and 4, again, you come up with an angle of arrival. In order for that to work well, I'll show you some of the photonic switches real fast at the kilohertz rate, and as such, it is capable that the switches are in the sensitive front end of your radio, and therefore the switches, unless they're very carefully done, are capable of making glitches. It's equivalent to having a battery with a wire that's short-circuiting the battery and a rusty nail, and you're scraping that in front of an antenna of a receiver. You do that, and you'll hear lots of static, particularly on an AM radio, and you would even hear it to some degree on a 2-meter radio. So the way you're connecting and disconnecting very rapidly those switches can make some really nasty electromagnetic interference to that radio, and the radio can become highly desensitized. So you want to make sure that the waveform by which you're turning on and off those switches is a nice controlled waveform, which without any real sharp edges to it, which are making glitches. And you want the on-off ratio of the switches to be high enough. And you want them to be wired with the right length of wire. If the wire going to the antenna at 3 o'clock is a much, much longer coax cable than the wire going to the antenna at 12 o'clock, that'll create a glitch that's going to create an error. I think the way they usually set them up is in the vicinity of quarter wavelength of spacing. It can't be as much as a wavelength, otherwise you're going to have a huge ambiguity. So something in the vicinity of quarter wavelength, a third wavelength, I think will work pretty well. So worrying about that switching, worrying about the what's called the intercept point of those switches. Let me drop.
This is KMX Zulu. If you hear me when you're over.
Yeah, you're very noisy, Bill, but we will turn it over to you because I believe you built top scans. I know that Glenn KC2QIQ has done it. I know that Andy W2CDL has done it. So each of the guys who have built, I think Eric has also built KE2EJ, built the top scan. So each of the guys have fallen into some of these traps as to the things that don't work quite well. But you want to make that switch have pretty high intercept point. Otherwise, a strong signal nearby will create some phony signals in that switching network that desensitize the receiver. You drive close to a repeater like this particular one at Glen Oaks, where the signal coming out of the transmitter is so darn strong, and you try to operate your top scan there, your receiver becomes overloaded and does some funny things with that switching arrangement, if you know what I mean. So doing top scanning when you're, let me pick a number, 500 yards away from the repeater, unless you've done things real well, it's a difficult problem. So making a good DAP scan and getting rid of all these glitches does separate the men from the boys. Almost anything that's worth doing is going to be something unique enough that it's not going to work like absolutely the way you want it to the first time. You're going to have to do some troubleshooting and some tweaking on all DAP scans. One of the things I also worry about, Steve, let me drop this. If you'd like the antennas to all be the identical type, just being a whip or a quarter wave or whatever antenna, not quite enough. If the antenna is a short whip at 12 o'clock, and it's a 5/8 wave whip at 3 o'clock, and the 5/8 wave whip has a 2-to-1 Viswa, which is very tolerable, but it's on the Smith chart, the dot is in the vicinity of highly inductive, and the dot for the 12 o'clock antenna is on the Smith chart, where it's highly capacitive, the impedance match of the antenna creates another phase shift, which is going to confuse the daylights out of the system. So one of the important parameters is that each of the four antennas should not only have a relatively low standing wave ratio, but whatever standing wave ratio they have should be the same kind. You can have a standing wave ratio of 2-to-1 where the antenna is acting like a 100-ohm resistor or a 25-ohm resistor. They're both 2-to-1. Or you can have a 2-to-1 Viswa where there's also 35 ohms of capacitor reactance or 35 ohms of inductive reactance. Those differences between the antennas will drive the system crazy. So try to make the Viswas low, and if not, let me drop. You can operate a DAP scan with the Viswas pretty high, if and only if each of the DAP scan antennas are in the same direction from the center of that Smith chart. As long as they're all inductive, no problem. As long as they're all capacitive, no problem. Some of them are inductive and some of them capacitive, that ain't good. If some of them are low in resistance and some of them are high in resistance, that ain't good. It'll confuse the hell out of the system because even if the signal is coming from straight above, where there is no Doppler shift, that difference of the antenna when you switch into it and switch out of it will create a phase shift in the receiver, which will be interpreted as a certain direction of arrival, and you confuse the daylights out of the system. So, gotta be a little bit careful, as you can tell. It's a very worthwhile project. When they're tuned correctly, boy, they're a lot of fun to use. But you gotta get past all these glitches. Let's see how many of those glitches Bill has run into. WB2QGZ, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, good evening, WB2QGZ. I apologize for the less than optimal signal, and I'll be brief. So first order of business, I prefer somewhat rigid quarter waves because the 5/8 antennas tend to whip around physically, mechanically, and don't necessarily stay in the plane we need them to be in. And the practical seat-of-the-pants fix to how the antenna layout on your vehicle works, at least in my probably 20-year-old Doppler system DOPSCAN unit, is I have a trim control right on the front panel. So pretty much I go out in front of my vehicle a couple hundred feet away, I trim it to zero, and I just verify that at 180 and 270 that I'm pretty close as I walk around the vehicle. And that makes up for any day-to-day change as I throw my mag mounts on. And I would imagine most units have that sort of trim control back to net.
Yeah, that's good information, Bill. One other thing you got to worry about is that if Bill was doing that testing at the 0, 90, 180, and 270 degree points and sending a signal from his handy-talkie to his car and looking at what his DOPSCAN reads and then adjusting the trim control, I do strongly recommend you do that in the middle of a very large parking lot. You do that in your driveway where you didn't realize you're getting a reflection off the downspout tubing from your house because you're standing close to it when you're at the 12 o'clock, the 6 o'clock position. The car is aimed out of the driveway toward the back of the car toward the house. And when you're standing at the 9 o'clock position, the 270 degree point, you're standing near a tree which is giving you a reflection. So the other reflecting objects in your environment will confuse your DOPS scanner. When the vehicle is moving, that jazz kind of integrates out. But when you're doing a fixed location of a vehicle and you're doing that test, try to do it where you've got nice flat land and you're not getting other reflections confusing the calibration procedure. So don't let all this jazz scare you, Steve. I'm just trying to tell you where the minefield is. When you see some of these glitches, you now know a little bit about what to look for. And there are enough people on this net who have built and tuned these things, so they'll eventually make it fly. KC2MDP, K2RIW. You got it, Steve.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Yes, you've, all that information is greatly helpful. Yes, I've run into a few of those glitches. I tried tuning it, for the north antenna and, adjusted the trim pot, and sure enough, I got that to work. And like you said, I did it in the driveway, and when I put the thing to the east, I must have got a reflection because it said the signal was coming from the west. So you verified a lot of my problems, and at least I know what they are and know how to correct them. I greatly appreciate it.
Okay, sounds like you passed it back to us, Steve. And Steve, as you do the tuning, aligning, deglitching, debugging, whatever, of your DOPSCAN system, please come back and sign in periodically and tell us how it goes, tell us the successes and the failures, because you're one of the guys going through it. And once you solve all these problems and you convince other people to build DOPSCANners, and as the population of LIMARC and other Long Island repeaters increases with DOPSCANners, then more and more of the other not-so-friendly people out there will be discovered, and the fox hunting will go better. The real foxes or the phony foxes will be much better. So keep up the good work. Mike was the next guy who signed in. November 2, Yankee Lemur. Hope you're in a higher location, Mike. Also, you may have to move if you're doing it with a handy-talkie, if you're talking to us with a handy-talkie, because a lot of people don't realize that when you move around the room with your handy-talkie, you get the strongest signal on reception. It isn't necessarily the best location to transmit from, because when you're talking to a repeater, the transmit signal is a different frequency than the receive signal. So sometimes you have to move off to a direction where the receive signal gets a little bit weaker, and that might very well be a stronger transmitter location, if you know what I mean. November 2, Yankee Lima to take it, K2RIW. You got it, Mike.
Let the repeater drop, Dick.
Yep. We're going to let the repeater completely drop, and then we'll send it over to you, Mike.
good evening to you and everyone on the net. How's the copy, Dick, first of all? I'm up in Cortland Manor here, Upper Westchester, transmitting out of a Yagi antenna, and hopefully in the right direction towards the repeater. How's the copy? I'm on high power now.
You're 80% audio, 20% noise. You sound very good. Keep doing it, Mike. Go right ahead.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, my question has to do with an MSJ 269 SWR analyzer. Just picked one up, started playing with it. Actually, I've been playing with a homebrew J-pole antenna made out of a 300 ohm twin lead. My question is, when I follow the specs that I picked up online of cutting the J-pole, I got a high SWR, like maybe 3 or 4 to 1 or something like that. But the impedance I noticed was about 50 ohms. When I started trimming the J-pole to get a lower SWR for the frequency I wanted to cut it to, I noticed that the impedance started going up very high. Is that normal? And also, there's other things. I don't know if you're familiar with this meter I'm talking about. There's also a resistance, and then there's, a reactance. That's the excess. Maybe you could shed some light on the proper use of the meter if you're familiar with it. Over.
BPC with fast comments.
You've got it, Hal.
Okay, Dick, and everybody, hello, the TechNet. Okay, basically, you're building yourself a J-pole antenna. Forget about feeding it to begin with. If you get your hands on the grid dip meter, physically put together the J-pole. Put the grid dip meter near the base of the J-pole and see first if it resonates at about 145 megahertz. Depending on the materials you use to build the J-pole, you may not have the antenna resonant to begin with. So neglecting the feed line, make sure the J-pole is resonant by itself. That's rule number one. Rule number two, if you're going to feed it with coax, connect your coax on the lowest part of the J-pole on the base of the quarter wave section. Go into your antenna analyzer, then start bringing your feed point of the coax up very slowly on the J-pole, and you'll find the sweet 50 ohm point. Your J-pole will already be resonant, and you should really get a good flat match. It's K6DPZone.
Yeah, this is K2RIW, and I think it's a good procedure, Hal. I'm going to give a couple of words to it as to what's going on. The antenna analyzer, almost all antenna analyzers, are kind of a poor man's equivalent of a vector network analyzer. But the bottom line is they're capable of reading both the resistive component and the reactive component of the impedance of something, your antenna, your amplifier, any one of those things. And this is the best of all worlds. The device under test, whether it be your antenna, in your case, your J-pole, it likes to present a 50 ohm resistance and 0 ohms of reactance, okay? As you go through various ways of tuning your J-pole or any other antenna, it's possible that the resistive component might go down to, let me pick a number, 30 ohms, when you'd like it to be 50. However, that may be the place where the reactance is not so high. Therefore, the VisLoads goes down. I could have a 50 ohm resistive component of a device on the test. Let me drop.
Resistive component.
The resistive component could be 50 ohms. If there's any amount of reactance beyond 0 ohms, either positive reactance, which means inductance, or negative reactance, which means capacitance, the VisLoad will climb real fast. You get that reactance when it's out of resonance. So Hal is telling you, make sure it's resonant first. That's the easiest way to kill that reactive component. So you were looking at the resistive component, and you were concentrating on that, and that's part of the story. That reactive component is important. You're trying to drive it to zero. As the antenna becomes longer or shorter, the primary effect is it's going to affect the reactive component. If the antenna is too short, the reactive component will be capacitive or negative. If the antenna is a little bit too long, the reactive component will be inductive or positive. You want to drive the reactive component to zero. So making between those two things, resistive component and reactor component. And looking at just one is only half the story, and that maybe is creating some of the confusion, Mike. Let me pass it to Hal if he wants to add anything to this. K6DPZ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, K6TPZ. Now, you had the right approach there. I was just thinking of the simplest way to get started, because if the J-pole is not resonant to begin with, you're going to be so far off in left field, be it resistive, be it reactive, capacitive, or inductive. But depending, as I said, of the materials the J-pole is made of, first see if the J-pole is resonant. And then use the antenna analyzer, making sure the antenna analyzer terminated first, 50 ohms. Make sure the antenna analyzer is working properly. Because many times if you bought a used antenna analyzer, somebody could have damaged it internally, and you'll never get a 50 ohm match. So get a little 50 ohm resistor or a dummy load, put on the analyzer, it should read flat. As far as the 50 ohms on the impedance scale, zero on the VSWR scale. And then basically you can work from there, and you, as long as you're reading 50 ohms, if you want to feed the J-pole with 300 ohms, if you have an analyzer that will read 300 ohm impedance, you can do it with 300, you can do it with 75, all depending on the device and the feed line cable you're using to develop this antenna. Go ahead, K2RAW, K6DPZ.
Anybody who has ever swept an antenna, in other words, you're moving the frequency while checking the standing wave ratio and plotting it, almost every properly operating antenna will give you what's called a bathtub curve. At the center frequency where it's really tuned well, you'll see a very low VSWR. And as you go higher or lower than that frequency, you'll see the VSWR start to climb. And if you plot that, it becomes a U-shaped curve or a bathtub-shaped curve. With your antenna analyzer, if you were a scientist, you would realize that as you tune away from the resonant frequency, and the VSWR is beginning to climb, the majority of that VSWR is you're starting to acquire a reactive component. The resistive component, in general, moves very slowly when you go off frequency. The reactive component goes like the hammers of hell. It moves fast. And that's the reason why your antenna has got a finite bandwidth and this bathtub-shaped curve. So that gives you a little bit more feeling of how reactance is so damn important, and getting it resonant, which is really getting the reactor component down, why that puts you a leg up on this tuning procedure, if you know what I mean. And what you're doing is a balancing act between adjusting the right length of the antenna and the right position for your feed line on that antenna. Over to you, Mike. November 2, Yankee Lima. And you're allowed to come back next week and ask us more about this. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, just thanks to you and Hal. I think you've got a gentleman out there. So the reacting, as long as I get it down to zero, that means the antenna's resonating from what I'm understanding. And then I just have to more or less worry about the SWR, try to get it down one way or another. Is that correct?
You're on the right track, Mike. And now you know a little bit more what the goal looks like. And don't be too much of a stickler on this. Almost every piece of electronics will be very happy at anything below 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. Many pieces of VHF equipment that you're using your J-pole on will be quite tolerant of a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. There are people who get a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, and they lose a whole lot of sleep at night, and the piece of equipment may work like a charm with that. I'll admit that on 40 meters and 20 meters, your modern-day no-tune radios are a lot more persnickety on that. Many of them will start their cutting back in power at around a 1.5 standing wave ratio. But most VHF equipment is quite a bit more tolerant. So you get it in the 1.5 area. You're essentially in the ballpark near home plate. And do you have to really get it down to 1.001? Well, if you like doing that as an occupation, go ahead. But you're gilding the lily, if you know what I mean. So the 3-to-1 and 4-to-1 that you talked about, without a doubt, that's alarming. When you get it down a little bit below 2-to-1 and 1.5, you are there. And with these tuning procedures we've just described to you, I'm almost positive you're going to find it. Next week, you're going to come back and tell us, hey, it's working like a charm. Okay, the next person who signed.
One more thing. Yeah, if you could say a few words about the capacitive character of an antenna and inductive.
asking you, why is it half capacitor inductor reactants? I'm going to tell you the secret. I own 50 books on antennas, textbooks, some of them extremely well-respected textbooks. The Jasek and Johnson Antenna Engineering Handbook, or the Velasic Antenna Engineering Handbook. We're talking about $150 books here. They don't tell you this secret I'm about to give you. Make sure you don't tell anybody. Just we hams that sign into the TechNet are going to keep this close to our chest. Here it is. You'd like to believe that signal... Let me drop. You'd like to believe that that signal you put into your antenna goes down the feed line, hits the antenna, and jumps into space. Absolutely not. About 5% of that signal jumps into space as it runs down the wire of your transmission of your antenna the first time. The signal comes to the end of the wire, 95% of the energy is there, it's left over, and it reflects back. The bottom line of all this is the signal on your antenna is going to bounce back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. Roughly 5% of the power radiates on each bounce. I'm rounding up the numbers a little bit, but this is close enough to get the concept across. What resonance means is that you want all of those bounces to stay in step with each other, to stay co-phase. You make the antenna a little bit too long. The signal bouncing off the end and coming back comes back a little bit late. A little bit late is sensed by the feed line and your instrumentation as a lagging phase angle. It came back late. The instrumentation, your antenna analyzer, your vector network analyzer will say, hey, that late phase, it calls it inductance. Just a set of words that the electronic engineers understand with each other. Let me drop. So coming back late, we call it inductive. Make the antenna, by comparison, too short, the signal comes back too soon. It's got a leading phase angle. We call that capacitive. Any reactants, capacitive or inductive, any out-of-phase characteristic of that signal bouncing back and forth on the antenna gives you some grief. So by adjusting the right electrical length, you're now making it resonant. You want all those 20 bounces to stay in step with each other, to be co-phase, and when you do that, you don't see the signal leading or lagging a phase, you see it right on the money, and we call that a perfect non-reactance load, and now all you got to do is adjust the resistive component by sliding your feed line up and down. So you're getting a little bit more of a hint of why the length of the antenna is so damn important, and it's the one that will kill you first if you've got the antenna mistuned. Let's see if that makes a little more sense to you, Mike. By the way, the first time you hear this, it's going to sound crazy. You can play back the recording on amateurradio.tv a few times. It'll make more sense. And as I said, this method of explanation, the signal bouncing back and forth, there is no respected antenna book that says those words. I'm very disappointed by that. They tell you it's a standing wave structure. They tell you that it's got a finite Q of 20. They use a bunch of other words that hint at that, but they never tell you where the rubber meets the road. The signal's got to bounce back and forth on the antenna because radiation is hard. You've got to kick that signal in the tail 20 times in a row before all of it leaves your antenna. That's the bottom line. That's what we amateurs are damn good at tuning because we've learned that nasty procedure. And to Yankee Lima, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mike.
Thanks, Dick. You explained that very well. Now I understand what's going on. Thanks to Wes for asking that question and you answering it. That helps a lot, out of the lag and the lead and all that stuff of the phase. I appreciate it. I'll play around with this, and maybe I'll come back next week and I'll let you know what I discovered here. And to YYL, back in that.
Is it Yankee Lima or Yankee Oscar, your call, Mike? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's November 2, Yankee Lima.
Very fine. So I did get it right. I thought I did. When you have a slightly noisy circuit, it's easy to get ambiguity. Okay. The next guy is Rich. He's going to tell us what state he's in. I know what state of mind he's in. I wonder if he's driving or if he's in the rest period between him and his co-driver on that vehicle that's whipping across the United States. And Rich, I'm convinced that you spent almost all of your life moving at 60 miles an hour. Boy, are you a mover. I think you told me you put on a quarter of a million miles per year doing all the driving you do. And it's very nice you're able to talk to us as you drive along. So how are those antennas treating you this week, Rich? K2, Victor, UPS, Uncle Papa Sierra. You got it, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And I'm in southwestern Pennsylvania right now, I-70. Just came through Washington, Pennsylvania. My question tonight is, I have a Jeep as a personal vehicle, and I have both a soft top and a hard top for it, and the hard top I believe is made out of fiberglass or some sort of plastic, roughly about a quarter inch thick in most areas of the roof. I want to put an antenna mounted in the middle of the roof for 2 meters and 440. I know they make half-wave antennas that don't need a ground plane. I'm using one of them now on the back, but the results are so-so. So I want to mount it in the center, and I want to have some sort of ground plane under there, whether it be a sheet of copper tape, whether it be some other kind of metal. But I believe it should be 19-inch radius to get the best results on 2 meters. So my question is, will I gain anything by making it bigger than that? Like, should I try to cover the whole interior of back there, maybe 3 foot square or 4 foot square area, or would a 19-inch radius circle be enough? Sometimes I might be operating a 5/8 whip, sometimes it might be a dual band, sometimes it might only be a 440, but I'd like to optimize it for 2 meters. So that's the question.
You got it, Hal. I bet you've done this already.
If the diameter of the circle to be about 38-inch diameter, not radius, 38-inch diameter, and then put a 19-inch spike in the center, that would give you a quarter wave on 2 meters, three-quarter wave on 440. Cheap and dirty, and it will work great. Go ahead, K2RIW, K6DPC.
Rich did say 19-inch radius, which is 38-inch diameter. He said those words, Hal. And I believe that 19-inch radius will be sufficient. You're sort of asking the question, will you gain any more performance if you made the whole top of the car sheet metal? And I think the answer is yes, but I think it's a very diminishing return. I think the difference is going to be awfully small. If this is the best of all worlds, your whole car would be one great big flat sheet of metal with the monopole antenna and a geometric center at the highest location on the vehicle. Because one of the crazy things that happens with a mobile mounted antenna is it tends to fire in the direction of maximum mass of automobile. If, for instance, you mounted an antenna on the rear right hand bumper of the car, you'd have a stronger signal going to the rear left-hand direction, if you know what I mean. But putting it in the middle, that problem goes away. As I said, I haven't actually done the experiment, but most of my fiddling with antennas leads me to believe that 19-inch circle is going to do it. And I think you could, if you wanted to, make four radials of 19-inch wide each out of wide pieces of aluminum tape. And I think you would get close to the same performance as the 19-inch diameter circle. That in itself would be a good experiment to use four wide metal tapes, so to speak, soldered together at the center, and drive some.
AC2QAQ with a comment.
Yeah, Big Golf Zulu, if you hear me.
Glenn and Bill in that order. But if you put these four radials down of wide pieces of metal tape, 19 inches long, and you do a test where you're in a great big parking lot listening to a particular repeater, we'll say, and you drive circles, and you look at the single strand versus your circle, and then you go over to the full disc, 19-inch radius, I think you're going to find very little difference. So let's find out what Glenn and Bill have to say in that order. I bet you've done something like this, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. I've had a lot of Jeeps over the years, Renegades, soft tops, hard tops, Liberties, all kinds of Jeeps. And yes, if you've got the metal top on the non-Renegade type, putting the antenna in the middle is the way to go. Unfortunately, the other Jeeps that have soft tops or the convertible tops, it just doesn't work. You can actually try putting circles in there. Just about everything under the sun to try to make ground radials on the roof just doesn't work. I hate to say it. But what will work is what you really want to do is have a Class 3 hitch on the back of the car and then put a mast. Basically, have a mast bolted to your Class 3 receiver, but it has to be the bolting type. In other words, when you slide the receiver in, the 2-inch receiver, you have to have the bolt that anchors it so that it grounds very, very well, and then run a mast up the back to clear the top of the roof, and then have your antenna mount basically mounted just above the top of the mast, and then you'll be perfect in just about all directions. Works 5/8 wave, half wave, quarter, just about anything you put on there will work like a charm. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Doc, good advice, Glenn. Glad to hear it. You've been there. When you say on the fiberglass top and soft top, when you tried various diameters, radials, and whatever, and you said it didn't work, give us a couple words on it didn't work. Was your standing wave ratio high? Was the signal to the repeater and from the repeater what lower than you thought it should be? You drove circles in a parking lot, and you found all kinds of peaks and valleys of the pattern. What was your definition of it didn't work, Bill? Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, sure, Dick. Basically, what I had noticed was that you can add ground radials, you can do just about anything to the antenna, and you'll always get the match. The match will always be there. But I think the hardest thing that you're going to achieve is that you'll find out that the pattern on the antenna is awful. It becomes very, very close distance. It's almost like trying to work with a handy talkie. Your match is good, but it almost feels like you're talking into a dummy load. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm going to add a little bit of a theory to this one before I turn it over to Bill, and that is a real vertical ground plane antenna. Let me drop. A real vertical ground plane antenna would like to think that it is operating against an infinite sheet of metal. And if you can't get that, then it would like to be a pure vertical half wave or antenna so that it doesn't require a ground plane at all. And so, as I see it, the radials of a circle on the top of the Jeep is a poor man's equivalent of that great big sheet of metal. Therefore, the antenna doesn't give us clean a pattern. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. You've done some of these experiments, Bill, let's see what you found. W2QGZ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Good evening again. I apologize for the subpar signal. I have had what Glenn suggests will absolutely rock. That'll work great. What I've had some luck with is a couple of quarter waves with about 2-inch wide copper foil tape stuck up underneath them like a ground plane. And if, I think it's Rich, KQUPS, if he'd like some of that, I have some. I'm good in QRZ. He can email me and I'll give him what he needs. But I've used that and it worked okay. Also, sort of following the lead of John Papson, WE2CIK, I did fool with a sort of sexually polarized antenna, single element, this is only a fiberglass cap and pickup, not a Jeep, so maybe physically there's some difference there. But I was able to make, elements at 90 to each other, feed them, I said in my hand circular because that's what I did, in the foil tape with a cheesy kind of gamma match sort of affair made out of foil tape. And it didn't work, it didn't fail, it didn't work incredibly well, but it showed no external antenna whatsoever. And it worked under the cap, but I did find that the ground plane of approximately 19, 20, 21, 22 inches underneath the VHF antenna in the fiberglass cap for pickup worked okay with that 3-inch wide or 2-inch wide copper foil tape. Glad.
Good information, Bill. Glad you made it work, and it sounds like that's a possible way to go. It's going to take some experimenting, Rich. We amateurs are tinkerers, and so... You have the resources of putting the
tape on the fiberglass antenna, building the Class 3 trailer hitch mount approach, and doing both. And then you guys have heard very often what I did, where I have this square loop antenna that's horizontally polarized, mag mount on my station wagon, and a 5A tape whip. And on 2 meters, as I was doing those drives up to Utica, I flipped back and forth between the two, horizontal and vertical polarization, while talking to a purely horizontal polarized strong signal in southern New Jersey. And they both worked equally well, which amazed me. The polarization becomes randomized after long distances. So good luck with these experiments, Rich. K2UPS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2IS, query.
Let Rich take it first. Rich, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Dick. K2UPS, mobile returning. But I heard Hal's response about putting the quarter wave up. I want a little bit more gain than that. I have quarter wave whips at home, and I have 5/8. I have collinears on 440, and also the collinear that's a dual band that's supposedly a half wave and doesn't need a ground plane. I have like 3 different manufacturers, and I do have a mast on the back of the Jeep right now, but it does not go to a hitch receiver. It actually gets bolted in behind the spare tire and is grounded up against the tailgate. And I'm just not that happy with the performance. I used to have even a half-wave antenna mounted on a mag mount in the middle of my pickup truck, and that worked a lot better. That's why I'm thinking about putting some metal up there. And even on the inside, even on the outside, I could paint it black to match the rest of the roof. That doesn't bother me. But I was just concerned basically about the size of it. So I'm going to play around with some stuff. I'll buy one of those NMO mounts that's for thicker surfaces than just cheap metal. I think that'll work. And then I'll go experiment with some different antennas and different either radials or tape or disc underneath, and I'll let you know how it works out. Back to net.
KC2, QIQ with a comment on that one.
With a comment?
Yeah, we got the AC2IS, KC2QIQ, and K6DPZ in that order. AC2IS, go right ahead, Bill, K2LIW, and you got to put an antenna on your roof one of these days, Bill, go ahead.
This is AC2IS. Yeah, maybe I'll put a ground plane on my roof, and I'm looking at a ground plane antenna right now that I'm not using at the moment, but not connected to my radio at the moment, but it's basically an SO239 connector with I guess you call them radials, wires coming out from the corners of it, but they're angled down a bit. They're not sticking straight out. So I'm wondering why that's optimal for this type of ground plane antenna. Is there something different about this? Is this some other category of ground plane antenna than what you're talking about?
A full half-wave dipole in free space is something like 72 ohms of impedance. If you had an infinite sheet of metal in the middle of that dipole at right angles normal to the wire of the dipole, and you put it there, nothing would happen. Once that sheet of metal is there, you can decide to feed the right-hand side of the dipole versus the sheet of metal, and you get absolutely no change in the pattern, no change in the gain. But now you're feeding half the dipole against an infinite sheet of metal, and the 72 ohms becomes 36 ohms, half the impedance. So an ordinary quarter wave whip with an infinite sheet of metal is very close to 35 ohms, 36 ohms of impedance. When you take those 3 radials and you tilt them down, even though they're still a quarter wave length long, even they still block the signal that's going to crawl down the outside of the coax cable, the transmission line, the impedance goes up, and if you tilt them just the right amount, the impedance goes up to 50 ohms instead of 36, and you get a better match.